We're going to get going on this just so that we don't run out of time. I'm going to jump into the source code auditing talk. And then, like I said, I have four exploitation talks after that. We'll see how much time we have for each one of them. Probably, like the reverse engineering time, we kind of might run a little shy to finish them all. But it'll be good. It'll be good. So the source code auditing talk is pretty cool because it was inspired by real-life events. I call it Once Upon a Smoking. And anyway, I'm not going to get into that. Who does source code auditing? Why do they do it? Where are they at? What's a good book on it? There's a good book right there, The Art of Software Security Assessment. Excuse me. So pretty much if people make something like a bridge or source code or a .bat file or a really complex server file or anything like that, it's going to have problems. So it may not matter that your little script doesn't work well. That's okay. But if it's like Internet Explorer or DNS or something like that that doesn't work well, then that could be bad. So we've talked about the reverse engineering and the fuzzing. This is the source code auditing portion of that. Okay. So when you're going to audit source code, it kind of depends on what source you're looking at and what approach you're going to take. So there's automated testing tools like free ones like RATS and more expensive ones like Fortify. The lead-in for the Fortify one is that, again, at the Iron Chef fuzzing thing today right after lunch, Fortify is going head-to-head with Charlie Miller and the fuzzing stuff. So that should be pretty cool to see who wins, right, the source code auditing tool or the fuzzer guy. So I'm excited to see how that works. I get to judge that, and I have no idea how it's going to work, so I'm not sure how I'm going to judge it, but it should be fun. So, yeah. Okay, the other thing is, should I do this manually, right? Should I look through the code line by line, or should I use my tool? The answer to that is the same as it was for fuzzing. Do them both if possible. If you have time and budget, obviously the more the better. If you've got an automated tool, run that. And if you have time and budget and all that stuff and expertise, come back through and look through the code as much as possible, particular routines that are suspicious. In particular, managed or unmanaged routines, you know, again, we're talking about like C here, C++, where there's a potential for buffer overflows, things like that. On the web side, the web source code auditing, that's not going to be so much, you're not really so much auditing PHP to see if there's a buffer overflow. You're more like auditing that code to see if there's a problem with the design of the web page, like there's a bug type called file inclusions, or can a user access a page without first logging in? Those kinds of things is what you'd be auditing that particular type of code for. Okay, so in practice, you have guys that kind of, they focus a little more on the web auditing than they would on, say, the C, and probably either one of them would tackle like a Python or Perl job if they're consulting type firms. Today's learning is basically looking at some C code. I'll point to a line of code, and then I'll say, is there a problem with this or not, right? That'll be kind of the game. It'll be kind of fun. So, and it's kind of fairly realistic in the sense that they're not, like, totally obvious, like, stir copy type bugs. They're a little bit trickier than that. And that'd be kind of indicative of the bugs that you would actually find in C, right? Some of them are a little more subtle than others. Other ones kind of stand out at you. I would give you this code, and you could type it in, and you could run it right now, and you could maybe, I don't know, fuzz it or just enter in command line arguments to this program and see if it crashes or something like that. But I don't think you're going to have time to type this in fast enough to actually run it, unless you're really fast. So let's read through this C file first just to get started. At the top, you've got your includes, right? Excuse me. And then you've got some defines, like buffline is 16, word size is 2, dword is word plus word. You've got a couple of user functions like mylog and mycopy, right? And then in the main, you've got some statically declared buffers like buff 1, 2, and 3, all 16 bytes. And then you've got some dynamic character array pointers. So char star buff 4, if you're not like real up on your C, is basically going to be just kind of a pointer, kind of a placeholder. And then when you do a malloc, which gets memory later in life, then that memory is going to be associated with a pointer. Okay, does that make sense? And then we do if argc not equal 12. So this is a command line program written in C, so you have to give it 12 things, the name of the program plus these 11 other things for the program to go well. So here's the first line of code. Stir n copy buff 1, argv 1, size of buff 1. Take a second and look at that. Is there a problem with this line? Is there a bug in this line of code? One line of code. Buff 1, so you're going to copy argv 1 into buff 1, size of buff 1. So we shouldn't copy more. Who thinks there's a problem with it? Raise your hand if you think there's a bug with this line. few people. Raise your hand if you think this line's okay. Who thinks this line's okay? Okay, raise your hand if you don't know and you didn't raise your hand previously. That should be like everybody. Okay, good. Let's find out. So that is actually the first bug because StirNCopy does this deal where it'll copy, the size of buff is 16, right? That's what size of returns. Buff 1 is 16-byte buffer. So it'll copy 16 bytes into the first buffer, and then it'll stop because it hasn't yet reached a null, assuming that you gave it greater than 16 bytes for the first argument. argv1, not really the first argument. argv0 is the first argument, but argv1. So, but it doesn't null terminate the string. And the reason this class of bug is really ugly is because it's confusing. And when you're looking at code, you're like, ah, oh, God, was that StirNCopy or is it StirNCat? Because they're different. StirNCat's the opposite. It'll copy everything you told it to, plus it'll null terminate. So you'll have a one-byte overflow. So both of these would have given you a bug, right, if you do the actual size of. So it's kind of ugly like that to remember. So that's why I point out this first one, so that you recognize when you see ncopy or ncat, you could have a problem still, right? Even though those are the safe version, the n versions are the safe versions, because there's also strcopy and strcat, which totally obvious that could potentially have a bug, right? Because there's not even an n. There's no bound on the size. It'll just copy forever. Okay. So then we do a to y, which is ASCII to int. So we take argv2 and we turn it into an integer, put it in len, and then we do if len is less than 16, memcopy buff2 argv3 len. Okay, so let's think. Buff2 is 16 bytes. argv3 we don't know, could be whatever. And len, so it's got to be less than 16. So I think maybe we're okay. Who thinks there is a bug with this line? Raise your hand. There's a bug. Is there a bug? A couple hands. Is it okay? Raise your hand if it's okay. All right. Everybody's just going to say, I don't know, right? I don't know. Raise your hand if you're not sure. Yeah, there's a lot of those, too. A lot of them that still didn't raise their hand, so I don't know which category they're in. But that actually is a bug because what happens if you put in -4? That's less than 16, but it's also a huge number. It's like 4 billion and some change, right? If you see down at the bottom, -4 is a big number. And memcopy treats that as an unsigned int, where the comparison is signed. So the word signedness that I used for my previous, that word that I love, signedness, it comes into play quite often, right? So again, if you missed it, the comparison is signed, but the copy is unsigned, right? And that's a problem. Okay, that's two of the eight bugs down, six to go, maybe, maybe not. Let's find out. Maybe they're not problems. What about this? SN printf. So again, we're using the N version of the function here. So the N version is safe, right? Just like the StirNCopy and StirNCat is safe, SN printf is safe too, right? Is that true? So what are we copying? Buff is 16 bytes. No, buff is not. Buff was a dynamic pointer. It's not even defined. Okay, that's a slight bug there that buff isn't even defined. But assuming buff was defined, and you do malloc length plus 20 into buff, and then you do a check, you say if buff, and that's good, right? Because that makes sure that malloc didn't return 0. Because a common problem that people do is that right after malloc, they never check to see what malloc returned. Malloc should return a pointer to some memory, but it could fail, right? If you ask for too big of a number, maybe, or whatever. But they're doing the if buff, which is good, and then they're copying the data from argv3 into buff, right? But there's a length of 20. So looking closely, actually, this is okay here. There's no bug here. I know it's kind of a little tricky. You might be tempted to see an overflow here. But there's no problem here. So if it was greater than 16, because we're following the check from before, then we come down and do this, right? And we malloc enough memory for this. And we even check to see if malloc returns 0. Which it could have. So that's okay. That's good. Actually, that's a good piece of code. What about mylog? So there's this other function called mylog. Log error, so that's like the log number, and then buff is the buffer that we're going to log. And if we go over to mylog, we see that the syslog error message. So, let me think here. Is there a bug here? Well, as it turns out, there is actually a bug here. It should be, the mylog function, when it calls syslog, it should be error and format string and then the message, right? So we have kind of a straight up format bug here in code, okay? So when you use syslog, you have to specify a format specifier. My copy. My copy. That's probably suspicious, right? Whenever somebody's rolling their own stir copy kind of a thing, my copy. Let's take a look at that. So we've got argv4 into buff3. argv4, we don't know how long that is. We know that buff3 is 16 bytes, so better not be bigger than that. Let's see. In the my copy, we do if stirlen of source is less than 15. So that's good. That looks pretty good. While, what does star mean again? Everybody forgets that, right? And see, star is like deref, right? So we're going to actually get the byte at that position. While this isn't a null, essentially, copy from the source to the destination and then post increment. And do it and then put a null at the end when you're done. So actually, as it turns out, even though this was a very suspicious routine since it was called my copy, which those are often not done well, this one actually was done well. This is fine. There's no bug in this code. Okay? Fun little game, right? Everybody loves a source code audit. You're all going to run right out and apply for a source code auditing job? Maybe? Maybe not. Okay. Maybe it's just me that likes it. Stir n cat. So it's got the n, so that's good, right? That's not a problem, maybe. Size of buff 3 minus 1. That's good. It did the minus 1. That's actually needed with a stir n cat. So who thinks this is a bug? Raise your hand if you think this is a bug. Anybody brave enough to say you think it is? One guy thinks it is. Anybody think it's okay? Anybody brave enough to say it's okay? This guy thinks it's all right. And the rest don't know. Actually, this is a bug, right? Because stir ncat, if you forgot, it sort of leaves off, it starts where the other one left off. So my copy worked on buff3, and so does stir ncat, right? So it copies up to the first, there's a null in my copy, and then stir ncat's going to start right there at that null, and it's going to keep going from that point on. So the stir ncat by itself would have been okay, but since it works on the same buffer that my copy just worked on, there's an overflow there. Okay. Execl, binls, argv6.0. What does execl do? Well, that basically launches a program from inside of here. Uses fork and exec as kind of a traditional C thing to start another process. And the arguments to ls come from argv6, so they're user-supplied data. And generally, you want to be a little bit careful with that, right? That could potentially be considered suspicious because there's this thing called command injection, which if you've never heard about it, you can basically do something like semicolon, which is like add another command onto this command, semicolon bin ls or, you know, bin sh and start a shell or do something. There's sort of a command injection kind of thing that you can do. But as it turns out, you can't actually do that with execl. So execl is okay. It's not executed in a shell-like environment, so it won't interpret shell escape characters, okay? So even though it's kind of like you were like, you kind of started twitching when you saw that, it's okay. A lot of this code makes you twitch, right? It's not like the most, they're doing some weird stuff. But that's how code works sometimes. So maybe you would think that semicolon cat etsy password to look at the password file would have been something you could do, but you couldn't actually do that here with execl. Okay, so then we do, there's a comment in the code that says filter meta characters, and then they use a character pointer and they do a stir char, which is basically going to check a string to see if this character exists in there. So is there an ampersand in argv7? If there is, knock out the string. Null it out. Is there a backtick? Is there a semicolon? Is there a pipe? Those are all sort of command injection shell type strings that you really don't want to see show up if you're going to run another command within this command. Okay? So they're filtering out some stuff. That's good, right? Then we do a string length of argv7 because we want to make sure it's not bigger than 1024. And if that's the case, then we'll do malloc 20 plus that number, whatever it is, less than 1024, and get some memory, put it in buff4, and then we sprintf. So this is not the safe version of sprintf. This is sprintf, so this one's kind of suspicious. Actually, it should be. I think it's supposed to be. I think it's supposed to be, but it's not. No, it's not. No, it's printf. So we're putting that string plus whatever the user supplied into this buffer, right? That's right. And actually, it's okay because we set aside enough memory and we checked the link. So we sort of did the end part of the sn printf in the if statement, right? And you can't do the integer overflow thing here or anything like that because you're doing strlen, so it's counting the bytes in the character. You're not specifying a number. And it has to be less than 1024. Does that make sense why that's okay here? Even though every line in this program pretty much looks suspicious, but this one's okay. And then we do systembuf4. Who says that's okay? That's okay. It's okay to do that because we already filtered for meta characters. Nobody's brave enough. Who thinks that's a problem? Anybody think it's a problem? Nobody wants to. Yeah, this guy still thinks it's a problem. That's good. And everybody else is unclear whether or not this is problematic or not. Yeah, that's a problem, right? So we filtered for most of the ones that are naughty. So this is what's called blacklisting, right? If you're talking about ACLs, access control list on a router, or any kind of like code like this, you're sort of blacklisting. You're saying everything's okay except this, 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 and this. Well, the problem with blacklisting in general is if you forget one of the this, 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 and this, then you're kind of hosed, right? So it's better to flip that around and say nothing's okay except these, you know, the alpha characters A through Z or whatever it is that you think's okay. Nothing's okay except, so whitelisting, right, is kind of a better approach in general. Because in this case, they forgot the greater than arrow. They didn't filter that out. So you could actually do a command injection and overwrite the password file with whatever string you had supplied, which would be bad, right? If you don't know Unix, then maybe this isn't all that earth-shattering to you, but that's an important file in Unix. Okay. Then we got strcpy, argv8 into buff5. It's not a safe strcpy either, right? It's just straight-up strcpy. That seems kind of suspicious. Strcpy argv8 into buff5. So buff5 is dynamically allocated via malloc, right? Buff5 equals malloc. And malloc says the string length of argv8 plus the string length of argv9 plus 2, whatever that does, right? Maybe that helps somehow. And then we're going to put that into strcpy. And that's not real good. And let's take a look at the function that's right after that. And they're both not real good for the same reason. strncat is kind of doing the same thing. It's catting into that same buffer, but with the other argument. And ideally, this would be okay, and in most cases it would, because you've truly set aside, you've used strlang, strlen, you set aside enough size for both 8 and 9 plus 2, so that's okay. But the problem is if you make both strings massively huge, which granted may be somewhat hard to do in practice depending on the shell, but if you made them both like 7 and all Fs, and then the other one's 7 and all Fs, and then you add 2, it mallocs a buffer of size 0, and there's no check right after malloc, right? The other one, there was a if buff5 kind of a check right after malloc to make sure that it didn't return 0, but in this case, there's not. So since we didn't check the return after malloc, it could have rolled over in this case, and then you'd have the world's biggest buffer overflow into this itty-bitty zero-sized buffer. That'd be bad. Okay, and what about this guy? Who thinks this memcpy is problematic? Take a second and look at it. argv10 into buff6, string length of argv10. Raise your hand if you think that's bad. Nobody knows. That guy still knows. Good job. And, okay, yeah, that was a pretty easy one, actually, because argv10, we're not really sure what it is, but whatever it is, we take the length of it and we stuff it right into buff6. And buff6 is 16 bytes in length, so all you got to do is supply a string greater than 16 bytes and it'll be a buffer overflow. Does that make sense where we're going with this guy? Okay, cool. So it's straight up overflow there. And then we save the best for last. This one's always fun. I love this bug. It's we're looking at this for loop right here with this memcpy inside of it. I'll blow it up on the next slide so you can see it better. So here's the relevant code. We got to define word size is 2, and a D word is word size plus word size. And then what we're going to do is we're going to malloc 4 times D word, right? So we're going to set aside our buffer. So probably good, right? Are we good there? And then we're going to do this for loop that goes four times through the loop. If you're not up on your C, it's I0 less than 4, I++. So it's going to do this four times. And the memcopy, it's got this weird deal where it's like buff 7 plus 4 times I. What is that all about? Well, it's basically saying buff 7 plus 0 plus 4 plus 8 and plus 12. So it's going to copy in 4-byte chunks, right, four times. So it's going to copy like 16 bytes into buff 7. So I think we're good, right? Are we good? Are we okay there? Who thinks this is okay? Raise your hand if it's okay. Nobody knows? Nobody knows. I'm not even going to ask. It's hard to say. I know. Actually, this is a cool one. I call it the Mac Daddy because it deals with macros. And the way that macros get evaluated is when we did the malloc 4 times D word, it evaluates the multiplication before the addition. So you really have to be up on your macros in order to catch this bug. So it is kind of tricky like that. I didn't get it the first time I saw it. I'll admit that right up front. So you got 4 times 2, which is 8, plus 2 is 10. So you're only mallocing 10 bytes of buffer, 10 bytes of memory, and you're copying in 16 bytes. So you got a 6-byte overflow. So that's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool bug. I think that's a good introduction to the field of source code auditing. If you've never seen it before, I hope that piqued your interest. And let's see. How are we doing on time? That's a great question, you know. I should give that same C file to, like, the Fortify guys and see if their tool found all those bugs. I really don't know. The answer to the question is I don't know. I didn't try it. But that'd be a great thing to try. Any other quick questions before we move on to the... It's hard for me to see, so if I keep going like this, it's not because I'm like an Indian or trying to salute or anything like that. It's really very bright. Okay, so where was I? Oh, yeah. So we've done reverse engineering, we've done fuzzing, we've done source code auditing, and then we're going to jump into the exploitation. Okay, so who cares about exploitation? You know, it just depends. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about who does it. Hackers do it, maybe. Companies do it. Who knows? Maybe for security, maybe for not. What could you hack? What could be exploited, actually? What could you take down? Pretty much anything that runs code, you know. I don't know about your microwave, but a lot of other stuff. Cell phones, computers, cameras, firewalls, routers, cable modems. That was like the smallest drop of water in the world. So pretty much anything can be taken out like that. So what? Who cares? Oh, thanks, bro. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I forgot they were down there. Had one drop left. Basically, if the exploited process is running at a higher level, all of a sudden you are too. And that's kind of the so what. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the on sort of the intro stuff here. Software testing, pen testing, O-day hunting. They're kind of all related, and they're kind of all different in their own way. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about when they're different and why Nessus isn't really an exploit runner. It's more of a banner checker and those kinds of things. That's for a different talk. So there's a lot of different ways you can actually exploit. Technical exploitations of computer software, either remotely or locally or client-side or whatever, is not the only way to exploit something, right? You could, like, kick down somebody's back door and exploit the security of their home or whatever. I mean, obviously it's illegal and that's bad. But there's different ways to do this, right? Social engineering, supply chain, who knows? We're not going to really talk about that. We're talking about the technical elements really only here. And again, you know, maybe web hacking is big. Maybe all these other things are big. We're talking about more of the unmanaged code, memory corruption kinds of bugs here. Again, kind of staying in line with the C that we reverse engineered, we audited code. We're talking more about C-like code here still when we're talking about exploitation. So assume that you found a bug through fuzzing, reverse engineering, or whatever. You've got this kind of like, it's a bug. I want to go from kind of proof of concept to exploit sort of thing. What kind of things do you need to know to be able to do this? Well, kind of a lot is the answer to that. Operating system knowledge, architecture knowledge, software development knowledge, the knowledge of what the thing you're trying to exploit sort of looks like, reverse engineering skills and familiarity with the tools and debuggers, all the kind of things that we've talked about. So everything in this 2-hour talk so far, whatever it's been, has been sort of leading up to this, right? Those are the sort of skills that you need to be able to do this kind of stuff. And additionally, you might need to know about things like network programming and shell coding and all these kinds of exploitation sorts of things that we're not going to talk about in depth because we don't have time to get into all of it today. But we're going to, so the exploitation here is going to be kind of talking more about the bug categories than it is about sort of how to write shell code or something like that. Does that make sense? So we're going to talk about what's a heap overflow versus an off by one. Those kinds of things is what we're going to be hitting here. Again, more in line with the memory corruption type errors. Okay, so I have four lectures, and the first three kind of look like this. The first one talks about the traditional stack overflow and function pointer overwrite. Then we go into traditional heap overflow, off by one format strings in the second lecture. And then the newer stuff in the third lecture, like return to libc's, SCH overwrite, uninitialized variables, integer errors we kind of already saw with the negative four thing and the source code outing. And then the fourth lecture talks about even kind of the newer, kind of a little bit like what's going on right now in terms of exploitation. And we'll hit that too. And we're out at 12:30, so I'm going to kind of manage my time, hopefully wisely, up here as we go through these to hit the stuff that's kind of most important moving forward. So the straight-up stack overflow, again, we just looked at C, so hopefully we're kind of up on our C. We see that we call this foo, this function with argv1. Again, main takes three parameters always, right? The count of the command line arguments or the arguments passed in, the array of those arguments, and then the environment variables as well. You don't see that, but that gets passed to main as well. So there's three things that gets passed to main. So argv1 is like the command line argument because argv0 is the name of the program. So you run this program, it's like name of the program, and then whatever variable or argument you gave to it. And you pass it right over to foo, and foo does a straight-up stir copy with that array right into a static 12-byte buffer. So it's a buffer overflow, right? It's a straight-up stack overflow is what we're looking at here. And what we're talking about basically, when you're talking about stack overflow, if you've never heard of it, or if you're not sure exactly what it is, you're talking about corrupting memory on the stack. What kind of memory? Data? Not so much data. It could be data, but it's generally more we're talking about the in-band control flow information. That is the return address, right? You're talking about clobbering as one function called the other. There's a return address. If you can modify that, when it goes to return, instead of going back to the nice spot it should have went back to in code, it goes to who knows, wherever, right? It goes back up into the stack in your shell code or whatever, wherever it goes, depending on the architecture and what kind of protections are in place. So if we're looking at the stack, I told you earlier in the talk in the reverse engineering when we'd go back to the stack, you got the push, push, push for the arguments, right? And then you got the saved return address, the saved frame pointer, and then the local variables for whatever function that got called, right? In this case, it's a 12-byte buffer. And say that you copy in just like the word hello, everything's good, right? Because you didn't send that much data, just H-E-L-L-O and a null terminator to the string. So life is good. But if you put in like a bunch of A's and maybe like an address that points right back up to the top, instead of those A's, maybe you have shellcode. So the exploit in the traditional Unix world, kind of years ago kind of world before they had any protections on the stack and stuff, would be that you would just overwrite the return address and you could statically, like you could just use a debugger and you could look and say, hey, the address is 080C3508 or whatever it is. Put that number right over the return address and it would go back to that point on the stack every time because the stack didn't change at all in the Unix world traditionally. And you could just exploit it straight, simple, clean. Life was good. Things have gotten harder, unfortunately, for exploiter people. Or wait, I'm sorry. Fortunately, things have gotten better in terms of security, right? Isn't that what I'm supposed to say? Okay, so now the traditional Windows stack overflow was just a little bit different because you couldn't hard code the address of the stack return right there. So you had to do a technique, what they call the springboard, and that's basically revolving around the fact that you know where DLLs, certain DLLs like kernel, NTDLL, whatever, you know where they live in memory, and you could just search through that block that DLL and look for like I need to call EAX or I need to call a jump to stack pointer or whatever because you know that the stack pointer is like pointing right near your shell code or something like that, for example. And if you can bounce to a DLL, that'll bounce you back to your shell code even though the stack address is dynamic. You can't predict what the address will be on the stack. You can sort of find it relatively. Does that make sense how a springboard kind of works? So that's kind of the traditional springboard stack overflow in the Windows world. Things have gotten harder there too. And we'll talk about those modern protections that have made exploitation more difficult. Other OSs, other platforms, what I just said, your mileage will vary, right? Because it's going to depend on how all that stuff gets set up on the stack and how it works exactly depends on the operating system and the architecture. So the first and foremost defense to a Stack Overflow is what they call a stack canary. And this just kind of revolves around the old miner's analogy that, like, if you're going down in the mine and you've got the little canary in your hand and the canary dies, it's like, ah, we got to get out of here, right, because something's going bad. The air is getting bad, kind of a thing. That, I guess, is the name for stack canaries. And what that really is, if you're looking at that same stack model, so you got push, 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 return address, frame pointer, stack cookie is what Windows calls it, a cookie. Stack cookie, and it's just sort of like a randomly generated number. And when you do a stack overflow to overwrite the return address, you'll kill the canary too, or the cookie. You'll break the cookie. And so what they do is right before they return, they check the integrity of the cookie, and they say, is this number what it used to be? It's not. We're going to bail out and crash the program or whatever. We're going to abort the program because we feel like things have gone badly. So granted, it's going to kill the program, and maybe that is a vulnerability in itself. Maybe you can DOS a server by killing a stack cookie or whatever, but it at least gives a program a safe and sane way to bail out if it knows that it's going into a corrupted state. The second protection against stack overflows is what's called a non-executable stack, and that basically is, in memory, you're able to mark this page or this chunk of memory, you're able to mark it and say, hey, this is data. Nothing should ever execute on here, and your hardware has to support this in your operating system. They both have to be able to support that. Windows calls it DEP, data execution protection. You can make the stack or the heap or whatever. You can mark it as non-executable. So when it tries to execute code there, it'll abort. It'll bail out. And there's a newer technique called return to libc that sort of gets around that. And we'll talk about that later. Okay, so that was stack overflows. The second exploitation technique is kind of really a catch-all category, and so I just kind of put this in the first one because it's really like how this works totally is programmatically dependent, right? So maybe you can overwrite a function that's on the stack, but you don't clobber the stack cookie, okay? Does that make sense? So maybe later in the program it goes to use that function pointer, and it thinks all is well because it never aborted, you never hit a stack cookie or anything like that. But you've somehow corrupted maybe some data like a function pointer or something. So it's kind of a generic catch-all class of exploits. This is just like some example. Like if you're not up on like how function pointers maybe get defined in C, maybe you just do something like int star new function int equals my function. So you're just setting some variable equal to my function. So instead of calling my function directly in code, maybe you have like an array of functions. Like there's 100 different functions. And based on what kind of packet they send me, if the number is, say it's a UDP parser or something. If this number is 3, I call this function because I know they're trying to log in. If this number is 4, I call this function because I know they're already logged in or whatever. And it calls different functions dynamically. That's maybe just one example. So this is just kind of a silly little game. It's kind of a little guessing game. And it's a guessing game that you can't win. And the game goes something like, enter a number 1 to 32,000, and it picks a different random number every time. So there's no real good way without using IDA Pro. Well, even that wouldn't necessarily help you. But a debugger, you could break, and you could stop, and you can view and see the number they chose, and you could put that in. But assuming we're not doing any debugging tricks and stuff, you're just kind of running this program from the command line, and you're like, man, every time I put in a number, I can't win this game. And it's supposed to call jackpot when you win, right? That's the idea of this little game. So it picks a random number. It says 30,000, and you put in 3, and you were wrong, so you get the game over thing every time you play, and it's no fun. But you start looking at the code here, and you notice that the number that you're allowed to put in, there's actually a buffer overflow there, which is kind of cool, but suppose maybe there's stack cookies or some kind of protection, so you're like, I can't like just run arbitrary code, but all I really want to do is just win this game. I want to call the jackpot function, right? And see, there's a stir copy. The input goes into buffer, and buffer is a static size buffer of 20 bytes. So you can actually clobber buffer. But you can clobber just enough beyond that. You don't have to clobber the return address and the stack cookie and everything else. You could clobber just the function pointer that's right next to that. Okay, that's the idea of what I'm talking about. Such that when it runs, I'll go back up to the code, when it runs this function pointer, A to I buffer, when it runs that, it's supposed to point to game. See, we set function pointer equal to game. But you could maybe make it set to jackpot. There's game. So this is the actual game that you can't win because it picks a random number every time. Ha, 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 you can't win. unless you somehow manage to actually randomly choose a number between one and between 30. I guess you could. You know, so it's whatever. And the jackpot function just looks like, hey, yay, you won. And that's just for this simple game, that's what we're trying to do. And you can actually use GDB if you start this program. I mentioned GDB as a debugger earlier in the talk. You could start this program in GDB, and you could do something like print jackpot, and it would show you the static address of that function is 0804-8744. So if you actually run the program like this game, and then this is some Unix foo stuff, the backtick is like run this program here and give the result to game. Printf, 20 bytes, and then we're talking little Indian here, right? Least significant byte order. You see how you got to kind of switch the bytes around. 0804-8744. Give it that number. When you actually run that program just like that, it's like, bam, you win just like that because you overflow just enough to overwrite the function pointer so that it called a different function than the one it was supposed to. Everybody see how that works? That's just kind of to give you kind of an introduction into, you know, things that you might want to be doing for exploitation. So that was the first talk. Let me see how we're doing on time. We're good. Good for time. Moving into the second exploitation lecture here. The first thing we're talking about here is, excuse me, heap overflows. So what's the heap and what's the stack? I've been talking about the stack, right? The stack is used for local variables and that function winding and unwinding business. I've been talking about that. But what's the heap actually do for us? Well, the heap is basically memory that you can grab dynamically at runtime by using something like new or malloc or alloc or whatever. And we've kind of been seeing that already. We saw that in the source code where we did something like char star pointer equals malloc 100. That gives us 100 bytes of data on the heap. Okay? As opposed to if we did char buff 100, that would give us 100 bytes on the stack. Does that make sense? And the heap kind of looks a little bit something like this, where you've got control. It's just like the stack. You end up with control information embedded right alongside with the data. So you get chunk header, chunk, chunk header, chunk. Just like on the stack, how we got data, return address, stuff like that. It's that same naughty business. And so, you know, you might ask yourself, well, why, if I'm an operating system designer, why do I do this? Why do I mix control information with data? Isn't that sort of a bad idea in general? It is really actually kind of a bad idea. And that's most all memory corruption errors have been a result of that. And so there were architectures designed that separated the two so that data was never near control flow information. But I think they just never won out in practice because of their lack of performance. I really don't know all the history off the top of my head. I could go hit the wiki machine, right? And so that's what happens when memory is malloc. But what about when you free it, when you give up the memory and you say, I don't need it anymore, right? You free pointer 1, and the header and the control information, it marks that chunk as free. And then when you free the second pointer, it marks that chunk as free too. And then there's this coalescing, this cleanup routine that comes along right back through, and it's like, oh, these guys are right next to each other. I could make a 200-byte buffer out of those two 100 bytes that are free. And that way, the next time somebody asks for memory, if it's like a 200-byte buffer, I'll have enough in one chunk that's right here and ready to go. So it's kind of a optimization with the heap. So the traditional heap overflow goes something like this. You overflow from one chunk right through the header to the other. Right? Does that make sense? Just like what we saw on the stack. But the way it works is different because you're not directly returning to anything in the chunk header, so it's not like you're going to call return and go back to some address. The way that the exploitation works is a little bit different, and this is kind of the traditional model we're going over here. There's some good talks out there if you want further resources. Like I know a buddy of mine, Atlas, gave a talk on older Unix heap overflow stuff. I think it was last year. Immunity's got a white paper out on Win32 heap exploitation. So there's a lot of good resources out there if you really want to dig into this stuff. So, but the general sort of deal you need to see to be able to exploit a heap overflow, generally, in the general, generic case, you need something like alloc, 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 free, clobber, overwrite, free. So you need a series of allocations and then overwrites and frees to kind of happen in somewhat close to the right order for this thing to work well. Now, when you talk about the control information that's in the header right before the chunk, it's like, well, what is that stuff? Well, it kind of depends. Like, you have the size of the chunk, the size of the previous chunk, the flags that describe this field, like, is this chunk free or is it in use? Things like that. That's the kind of control information I'm talking about. And if you were to, like, reverse engineer ntdll.dll on Windows 2000, you'd see that things like bit 0 and bit 3 need to be set, for example, for a heap overflow to go well, for it to be coalesced. So I'm not going to get into all the nitty-gritty details of doing that or going over and getting kind of stuck in the weeds on this one exploit category since we got a bunch more to go through, but that's kind of, I think, hopefully giving you the right idea. So when the first chunk gets freed, not only is the header, the chunk header gets changed so that it's marked as free now, but also the previous and next pointers kind of just get thrown in there where the data was. It sort of reuses that same memory area because the heap is laid out like a doubly linked list. And if you're not sure what a doubly linked list looks like, it's a computer science data structure that allows you to point from one object to the other and then back to another object from itself, right? So you can walk this link, chain of linked list and forward or backwards, right? And when you want to unlink, when you want to free a piece of memory, you basically need to get rid of one of those guys in the middle. And so how do you do that? Because what you want to create looks something like this, right? You want that one's free, so it's gone, right? What you do is the next, so that was in the second one, becomes the next to the first. So it just sort of points around that part of memory. It hasn't really gone anywhere, right? That memory is still sort of there, unless it comes back through later and nulls it out or cleans it up somehow. But that memory is still kind of hanging around, and that could be important later when we talk about uninitialized heap or stack bugs. And then the other pointer, the previous pointer of the third, instead of pointing back to the second, points back to the first. And so the idea, without getting too hung up on it, is that basically if you've overflown the chunk information of the second one and you get a couple frees such that a coalesce happens, you control those two pointers. So you get a free write somewhere in memory. So instead of the next, you know, pointing back to where it should with this data, you say, you know, go to this area in memory and put this data there. So you get to overwrite something with 4 bytes of data. Could be on the stack that you, maybe you clobber a return address so that you get kind of the stack overflow type experience, or maybe you overflow like a linkage type table, like a GOT, the global offset table in Unix, where you're like, whenever it calls printf, now it's going to call my shellcode kind of a thing, because you overflow like a virtual table pointer kind of a thing. So, yeah, that's the 4-byte write thing. The notes on heap exploitation is that pretty much it's a tricky sort of deal. It depends heavily on the platform, you know, on the architecture and the things that are in use. And it's a little unreliable in general because you can imagine as you're freeing and allocing and mallocing and freeing and stuff, the heap ends up in a state that's not always real predictable, right? It's not always completely known to you how it's laid out. So you might, the attack you're running might not work every time. Maybe it only works 80% of the time or something like that based on whether it actually gets coalesced or something. But sometimes there's things you can do to kind of help with the reliability of such an attack. Like maybe if it's a network server, maybe if you send all these packets first, a bunch of large packets, then the heap is always set up in a way that's predictable to you so that when you run your attack, it works like every time kind of a thing. Or maybe if you're exploiting a client-side exploit, which is somebody's web browser generally speaking, maybe you can run some JavaScript code on your web page before you do your attack against their browser or something like that so you can kind of stage it. And that's important in exploitation, that idea. So what are some defenses against heap overflows? Well, XP and Vista and stuff like that, modern versions of other operating systems have input like heap type protections that check the integrity of the control flow information. So if they ever see that this chunk header changed but they didn't do it kind of a thing, then abort. That kind of a thing. It's kind of similar to the idea of a stack cookie, really, in a way. So that was heap overflows. Off by ones, we kind of alluded to this earlier, so I'll kind of just cut to the chase with the code here. It's a stir ncat. When you do a stir ncat, notice this is kind of similar to the code we saw before in that we see a stir ncat buff, s, size of buff. So s is some pointer. And if we just do size of buff, it'll put in all 15 bytes, because it's 15-byte array we're talking about right here, plus it'll null terminate, right? So it should be size of buff minus 1. So again, there's some subtleness. And you're like, okay, but I get that. I see how a one byte overflow could occur. It clobbers the least significant byte of EBP with a zero. But boy, how does that make it exploitable? Because I mean, really, seriously, I'm just overwriting one byte with a null. That actually is not exploitable, is it? Well, I'm sorry. Okay, there's not. So he's saying in the Windows implementation of stirncat, it doesn't null terminate now? Okay, cool. I didn't know that. So I stand corrected on that for Windows, I guess. I've tried this on Unix. So anyway, going back to how this is exploitable, so if there's a stack cookie there, then actually it's not exploitable, right? Because you still have that sort of stack protection right there. The cookie will be different and it won't work. So with the modern protections in place, this isn't really exploitable either anyway, to your point. But in the traditional case, it was, because when you overflow that least significant byte, what would happen is the first stack unwind would be okay. The first stack unwind would look like base pointer and stack pointer, pop the base pointer, return, life is happy. But then when another function returned, it would go base pointer into stack pointer, but the base pointer had been corrupted just slightly from before. So it kind of slides the stack pointer higher than it should have been. And then we pop the base pointer, and then we pop the return address. But we're in user code now when we pop that return address. So kind of game over sort of a thing. So that's kind of the traditional case with an off by one. Format string exceptions, we've talked about a little bit already in the source code auditing deal, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time going over that. But pretty much, if you don't give a format specifier, things can go bad. And so here's the code. If we don't get two arguments, then we bail out. Otherwise, we do something useful. And so there's no problem with that, is there? Well, actually, we don't give a format specifier in the printf, but it's just in the error checking code, right? And that doesn't really matter because the error checking code never really gets run much, right? That's kind of I don't know if that's the reason why error checking code doesn't get tested as much, but I think it just, since it doesn't get hit as often, it doesn't get the same coverage in testing. So you tend to miss some of those bugs. So the printf argv1 is actually the error, and it's 9 times out of 10 you'll never hit that error, right? Because you're going to do something useful. You'll give it the right amount of arguments. So in the case where you do something like format and then you give it an argument and then it does something useful and then you're happy. But if you give it the wrong amount of arguments and you happen to also give it some format specifiers, it'll start doing stuff like popping strings and integers off the stack. So you see like 40, 13, 60, like maybe that was the base pointer or something. I don't know. That's pretty cool though, right? So you can start to see how a format string bug could be used almost like a mini debugger of sorts, which would be kind of interesting. And of course, if you use the %n, which now I know isn't available, I think on Windows, by default, they nix the %n because of this problem. You could actually write to memory. So you get sort of a free write in memory. So it would actually be exploitable. Just as before with the heap overflow, you get a free write somewhere in memory to clobber maybe your return address or whatever. Probably the greatest defense against stack format string bugs, besides the changes in use of code and stuff in Windows, they're always doing stuff to make their code better so that their programmers are trying to help their programmers from shooting themselves in the foot. Statically, these are really easy to detect. So it's kind of hard. Some of the subtler bugs we looked at, what was the looping thing with the defines and stuff. You know, some of those are kind of hard to detect in statically with the static analysis tools. But if it's just you have a printf and they didn't give a format specifier, that's a pretty easy thing to just grep through all your code and just look to see if that condition ever happened. And if it does, then fix it, right? Sort of thing. So these things have been kind of hunted to extinction through source code analysis tools. And that's the end of the second exploitation lecture. See, we're still good on time. Actually, we're really good on time. I'm moving through this faster than I thought I would. That'll be good. We'll get out for lunch on time. Hopefully I'll get you out before 12:30 so you can all run right over for lunch or stop by the book stand or whatever. So the third exploitation lecture, we're talking about return to libc's, SCH overwrites, uninitialized variables, and some integer errors, which we kind of alluded to already. So remember that I mentioned the protection, the non-executable stack. So with exploitation, security versus defense kind of thing, there's always this cat and mouse game that's been going on for years, right? It's sort of like the attackers are like, hey, we can just run a stack overflow, and that just gives us code execution. That's awesome. And then finally, you know, the defenders, after years and years of that happening all through like the 90s and 2000s and stuff like that, finally came and said, hey, we could make that non-executable. And then that'd be hard to do. And then the attackers came back and said, yeah, but we could just call a routine that exists on your system already with a return to libc type. They call it return to libc, and the reason they call that is because libc in the Unixy world is just a library that's often linked into your code. So functions like system and execves, execl, or whatever, they tend to just be there inside of your virtual process space somewhere. Okay? So if you can't execute your own arbitrary code on the stack, maybe you could just call the system somehow. And that's the idea, the motivation behind a return to libc. So here's some code, and we have just kind of a straight up stir copy kind of a deal where argv1 is clobbering buff, right? And that's kind of a straight up stack overflow because buff is 5 and argv1 is whatever. And the idea is that instead of overwriting the return address with, you know, some arbitrary number where your shellcode lives, maybe you could overwrite the return address with the address of system or execl. And so after that, you also need to set up the arguments, because the function calls, if you remember, go something like push, 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 call, right? Something like that. So they sort of expect the arguments to already be on the spec. So if you're going to call system with a string of like /bin/sh, which is how you spawn a shell on Unix, the comparable string in Windows would be something like the command.exe. It's sort of like the command line interface. If you want to launch that as the bad thing that you're trying to do, you need the address of that string also pushed to the stack, and then when you hit that return address, the call to system or whatever, it's going to call using the parameters that are on the stack. That's the point I'm trying to make, is that the parameters need to be situated well on the stack for this to go well. So if you compile that code I showed you a second ago, call it lame code, and then you see the kind of the Unix foo there with the back ticks, so it's going to execute Perl dash E printf A times 28. So it's going to print out 28 A's, and then it's going to print out some address of some function, right? Maybe that's execl, maybe that's system. And then some A's would be like the return address if you want to exit clean. And then the address of the string that you want to execute inside a system, say. And that'll actually work like that. So that's pretty cool. That gives you an idea anyway, if not all the info you might need, of how you might do a return to libc. They tend to work well against command line programs, since you can just call like /bin/sh. They might not work quite as well against remote programs. They might, you know, depending on what functions are there and available for you to call, depending on what's in the virtual address space. So the defense against the non-executable stack, again, the cat and mouse thing, well, what can we do? Okay, they can defeat the non-execute stack. What can we do? We could randomize the locations of all the stuff in memory, right? And then they wouldn't have a static address to know. They wouldn't know where system lives in memory, for example, right? And they call that ASLR, address space layout randomization. And that's kind of a way to augment NX. And we'll see at the very end, I'll talk about this, that all the protections that are in place now, it turned out that stack cookies on Windows ended up being pretty easy to defeat, and safe SEH was pretty easy to defeat. But if you combine ASLR and DEP together, it's a very effective defense. So SEH, I've mentioned this a couple times maybe now. What is that? It stands for Structured Exception Handling. And it's kind of a way that basically says, hey, if things go bad, I've got some pointers on the stack or wherever, and I know that I can walk that chain and say, try this, try this. If I can't figure out what to do, finally call this function, and that'll kind of help me deal with exceptions kind of a thing. Well, one of the things you could do, like with a traditional stack overflow, is suppose they put in the GS cookies like they did a few years ago, and it's like, oh, man, I can't do my straight-up stack overflow. But now I figured out that if I just keep overflowing way beyond the return address and overwrite these structured exception, which are basically function pointers, and keep going so far that I hit the end of the stack and I run out of memory, that causes like an out-of-memory type violation, an access type violation. And then it'll go to the structured exception handler, which you overwrote, and you can execute code like that. So does that make sense? That's pretty cool how those work. And so one of the defenses against SEH was, Windows was like, all right, well, okay, they're messing with our safe SEH pointers. We could protect each DLL. We could mark them with safe SEH so that, okay, you might want to springboard off NTDLL and then go back in your shellcode, but we're not going to let you do that because we're going to mark NTDLL with safe SEH that's called soft DEP as well is another word for it, such that you can't do that, right, because that exception handler isn't registered to be able to go to this DLL kind of thing. And that didn't end up being very hard to get around either, because you could just go to an arbitrary address on the heap or something that wasn't protected with SafeSCH. It only protected registered TLLs. So it wasn't, that in itself didn't, those two, SafeSCH and stat cookies, didn't seem like they were all that bad to get around. Maybe they were in some cases. Another category of bugs that's kind of a little more obscure and possibly, you know, hard to understand exactly how it all fits together and works is called uninitialized heap or stack. And I kind of alluded to this earlier, and it deals with the fact that when you're, like, say you wind the stack up and you've got some local variables, and then you unwind, you leave that function, you wind up, you wind down, all that data is just kind of stale. It's kind of hanging around on the stack in the heap, right? It doesn't ever really get cleaned up, generally speaking. And so, and this is just one example. There's other ways that uninitialized variables and stuff could go wrong. This is just one example. What if you just sort of left a value hanging around? And you knew from reverse engineering or whatever that later on they were going to use that number, say it was like a variable X or I or something, and they were going to use that as an index onto a pointer, and they just knew that generally speaking that was always zero. They just, I don't know, maybe they didn't think about it, or maybe they just found through testing that it just worked, they didn't have to set X equals zero, they just initialized int X without ever giving it an initial value. Okay, and it just generally worked. Well, maybe you leave the number 10,000 there or whatever, and it goes to use and uses that as an index on a pointer, and things go bad, right? Because all of a sudden it writes outside of memory. So there's weird kind of bugs like that. And they're kind of hard to find, and they're kind of hard to protect against for that same reason, because they're not like a general Stack Overflow where it's like we always know it'll have to go over this so we can put in a stack cookie, that kind of thing. Integer errors. We talked about this. This deals generally with numerical wrapping kind of a thing, where it's like you put in such a big number that it, you know, wraps all the way around from FFF back to zero or something like that. That's kind of the one that we showed earlier, or putting in a negative number, the signedness problem, where you put in a negative number and then it gets evaluated with signed once but then used as an unsigned number during a copy, something like that. There's lots of different ways that integers can go wrong, right? And it's sometimes hard to statically see, you know, is this good? Is this okay? Is this bad? There's another way that, like, signedness or whatever, integer errors could happen. This actually isn't a signedness error so much as it is an integer truncation kind of an issue. I'll just show. This is just one more quick example. So we read in an integer. We do A to I and argv1 and stick it in I. So we've got this int, right, this 4-byte number, and it's signed. Okay, fair enough. And then we want to make sure that it's not greater than, say, 10. So we call this function called check. And we check and we basically say, okay, check this. I don't want to deal with that whole numerical wrapping signed comparison kind of a deal that often goes wrong. So I'm going to make this an unsigned number, right? And then I'm going to do my comparison. I'm going to say if it's greater than or equal to 10, then bail out because that number's too big. And the whole putting in a negative number thing isn't going to work against me because I'm smarter than that. But for whatever reason, a mistake happens such that they use an unsigned short, which is only 2 bytes, and we gave it a signed 4-byte number, so we're only going to be evaluating the lower 2 bytes. So you end up, if what happens is if you put in a small number that's less than 5, it's like, okay, you're okay. And then you put in a big number like 30, and it's like, hey, you can't do that. That's too big. But if you put in a number that goes all the way past that 2-byte boundary, like 1,000 hex, then it just only, an unsigned short only evaluates the lower 2 bytes, and it's zero. So it's like, hey, that's okay, but then it uses 65,000 bytes as part of the copy. So things go wrong. Can potentially go wrong when you cast, if the casting gets done improperly. Okay, so we're kind of on the home stretch here on exploitation. So we've already talked about these, stack overflows, heap overflows, function pointer overwrites, off by ones, format strings, return to libc, sh, all this good stuff, right? Talked about a lot of good stuff today. I hope you guys enjoyed it. So the thing is, well, what's the state of exploitation as it really is sort of now? So Microsoft has got in Vista, right, in particular, and XP as well. They've got all these protections that are really quite good. And we're going to focus on the ones in kind of the upper left there, the generic exploit mitigation ones, like address space layout randomization, pointer obfuscation, the slash GS, which is the stack canary that I talked about, the data execution prevention, which is kind of making the heap in the stack non-executable, safe SEH, protecting DLLs so you can't springboard off of them, the secure heap manager to make sure that if there's any control flow information changed on the heap, we protect against that. So it's kind of like they've covered all their bases, right? They did a really good job in coming up with the security deals that are there. And yet, in the face of such amazing protections, we got my buddy Charlie Miller going to CanSec West, popping the Mac AirBook like that, taking home a 10K prize and a new laptop for landing an exploit on a MacBook. So it's like, how's he doing that if all these modern protections are there, right? And the same thing with the guys that grabbed the Vista book. How did they do that? And I've been trying to come up with a little jingle, you know, something like, client-side bugs, we love you, but I don't know what to sing, so I'm not a good singer. So maybe one of you guys can help me out with a little song or a little jingle or something like, client-side bugs rule. They're rocking the house. They've been rocking the house for a little while now. They're doing their thing, and they're still doing their thing. And what they do is they kind of work against bloated software that's on the desktop, like your browser, and Firefox, and IE, and Safari, and they do stuff like run JavaScript, and they view pictures, and they do all this stuff. They load Flash, and it plays a movie, and who knows what all kinds of things you can do through your client software, right? All kinds of amazing things that are really very cool, you know, even talking to somebody wherever in the world over Skype, and there's all these great applications that run on your desktop. And it turns out that some of them have problems. And somebody, not mentioning any names, released an exploit against a LinkedIn toolbar in 2007, found the bug, just simple fuzzing stuff using Comrader. And there's kind of a generic attack that's going on against, that's in use in client-side bugs called the heap spray, SEH overwrite with heap spray, and that's kind of what gets used here. And so we'll kind of pick that apart and see how a heap spray is actually working, because they still work right now, today. Somebody's doing it on your laptop. Sorry. It wasn't me. CLS ID, that's sort of the way that you can call this particular COM object. So a COM object, if you're not sure what it is, I'm talking about the LinkedIn toolbar for this particular exploit. It's basically something that when you, like, maybe registered for LinkedIn or whatever, it installed sort of a browser helper type object inside of IE or whatever. It's just some extra code that's going to make it, you know, maybe it so you can check your LinkedIn contacts right up in the toolbar of, right next to your Google search, quick search thing, or kind of just extra code that gets launched in. But in this case, there was a property inside of that COM object called search. So you do target.search and then a long string, and it was a straight-up Stack Overflow. It was like totally stir-copy kind of a bug. And so we just have to set up the code here, the web page code. And so the deal with client-side bugs is that you have to get somebody to browse a malicious page somehow. However that happens, I'm not going into that right now, but you could do it by sending them an email saying, hey, click on this link. Or there's tons of different ways that are even easier than that to basically get somebody to view a web page that has malicious code running on it. And a lot of time, as a big part of that malicious code, there's JavaScript inside of that as well. So we call the COM object. We do the script tag, and we call it JavaScript, so we're going to be running some JavaScript. And then we've got a repeat function that just builds a long string. Nothing fancy there. It's just going to help us build a string. And then we've got a return address. So I said it's a straight Stack Overflow, but the thing is we don't really know where to return to, right? Because we can't springboard off DLLs because they got those protected with safe SEH. And we couldn't just do a straight Stack Overflow because they got the slash GS in use. The stack cookies were protecting that. But the heap was not marked unexecutable, so you could still execute off the heap. So the idea behind the heap spray is that you fill up the heap with all this junk. And the junk is basically shellcode or no-ops that doesn't do anything in shellcode. And then you'll just randomly pick an address, not randomly, sort of knowingly, knowing that that big chunk of memory you're going to put on the heap tends to end up in the same place. The SEH overwrite that you do when you do your Stack Overflow, you'll overwrite it with a number that's going to return to the heap and execute some code. And it works like 95% of the time. It's not perfect, right, because heap spray it's not perfect, but we'll look at it a little bit more. So you got your shell code. That's going to pop up, calc if that runs, so it's benign. It's not a malicious exploit or anything like that. And then you've got this for loop down here, and it uses the word new. And new is kind of like malloc, right? So it's getting memory off the heap. And we're using nops plus shellcode, right? So the nops in this case was just a bunch of 0A0A0A0A. It evaluates to just like move EAX, EAX, or something like that. It's sort of a benign code that if it gets executed, But it's kind of cool and special in the fact that it's also the location I want to go to. It's also the no-ops I'm going to execute when I'm there. And if you dereference it, you get back to yourself. So it's kind of anytime you make an address, all the same number of it, like that 0A0A0A0, it's got that special property like that. And it's kind of cool like that. And so then you do the actual overflow. You do target.search, and then it took two parameters, and its first one apparently didn't matter. I never reverse engineered it to figure out what that parameter meant. And then I gave it blind jump, which was just 5,000 or 50,000 0A0A0A. So I just destroyed the stack with 0A0A0A, and then when it ran to the end of the stack, it hit an exception. It went to the structured exception handler, jumped to the address 0A0A0A0, which just happened to be on the heap, which just happened to be filled with no-ops and shellcode that ran and executed the code. So that's the kind of quick and dirty intro into heap spray client-side attack. Hope you enjoyed that. Oh, call the vulnerable function, yeah. Okay. Thoughts on heap spraying? They're not considered super sexy in the fact that they're a little slow because it's gotta fill up your heap with that stuff. And if you're on an older, slow machine or something, maybe that takes a while, or maybe you don't have a lot of memory on your machine or something like that. So it's not 100% reliable either on top of that. So heap sprays aren't perfect, but if they're done right, they tend to work well, and they defeat a lot of the protections like the stack canaries and the safe SEH. Now, the problem is they don't defeat the non-executable heap. So if you used ASLR and DEP, then this attack wouldn't work. But it did work because the problem is with DEP, it's hardly ever active on XP because it has to be configured by the user. You have to specifically go and say, protect this process with DEP kind of a thing. And in Vista, it's still an opt-in sort of thing. So the vendor of the third-party software would have to compile their program, the LinkedIn toolbar in this case, with the DEP and the ASLR and say, use these protections. And they didn't, as many of them still aren't, but many of them are now. So the final thought on that protection mechanism there is that though they weren't in use then, the ASLR and the DEP weren't in use then, it's coming down the road. We see it coming down the road, right? Newer versions of client-side softwares like Adobe 9 and QuickTime and stuff like that, they're starting to, Firefox 3 is a great example. If you're still running Firefox 2, upgrade to Firefox 3 and use it on Vista, and then you'll have ASLR and DEP. But if you're using Firefox 2 or 3 on XP, you won't. You know what I mean? So Firefox 3 on Vista, you're good, kind of a thing. Or IE 8, as it's not out yet, but the beta I think is out for IE 8. So it's gonna. That kind of stuff is getting better in terms of security. They're doing better. Let's see how we're. I left these slides at the very end because I wasn't sure if we had time. We do have a few more minutes. I'll kind of buzz through this real quick. So this was just kind of, if you were interested on how Charlie actually got the MacBook Air at CanSec West, he gave me some details on how his exploit worked. He didn't give me all the details. You can ask him later. And how some of the other client-side bugs work. So it's kind of similar to what I just described, the same sort of spirit, but it was actually a little bit different. Use the heap feng shui, which is the idea of staging the heap to be in a predictable state. So I talked about the fact that if you have a heap overflow, it's not always 100% predictable and repeatable and stuff like that. But if you can run JavaScript, by the way, just think about JavaScript. I love JavaScript. When you visit a web page, they're already running arbitrary code on your computer. I mean, it's not malicious, right? Because JavaScript supposedly doesn't exploit you and stuff like that. But they can do stuff like change the layout of your heap and stuff like that just by running new and free and stuff like that in JavaScript whenever you visit a web page. So because of that, you can download stuff like NoScript for Firefox and such, and you can make it so that you get to choose whether or not scripts you want them to run on your browser. So you might want to do that. You may want to look into NoScript for Firefox. It's kind of a cool addition. It'll break like every web page you want to visit. So how effective it is kind of you just end up sort of disabling it at the end of the day anyway. But the notion behind this attack was like, okay, I want to set up the heap and get it in a really special layout, right? So I'll malloc, or I'll do new on 1,000 buffers, each of size 4,000. So I'll have this huge heap laid out in this special way. And then I'll free like every other one of the last 100 buffers. So I'll have these holes in really predictable places, and I'll control the data on either side of those holes. This is kind of the idea between staging the heap. And then he'd send his attack, and it would fit right into one of those holes, because the next time a 4,000 byte buffer got mallocked, it would come from one of those chunks for sure, because they'd been recently freed. And then he could do a special overflow of some type and hit a function pointer. And I don't have all the details on how his attack worked, but it's pretty cool. And what would have saved the MacBook Air if they had more heat protections? ASLR wouldn't have saved it necessarily because you're not referencing anything, any static library. You're bouncing right to the heap. But if you had made the heap non-executable, that would have prevented this attack as well as the LinkedIn attack. So marking things as non-executable, particularly the heap, is going to start to disable a lot of client-side attacks. So I think that's it. We're to the very end. I just kind of make a few points on security in general. That OData to the desktop is kind of 2008's big problem. And you know, other types of like memory-only rootkits and technologies like that are kind of 2008's problem as well. So we have 8 minutes for questions. Any questions? If not, come see me or see me at the book stand. I'm headed right there, and you can talk with me further or go to lunch. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, man.